Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys again for joining us. Really appreciate everybody for listening, engaging with us on social media, and for liking that new YouTube page. We've got a live stream going. I don't know how long it'll last. There's tons of wires everywhere, but we're doing our best to kind of work out some of the kinks so that whenever you guys get us to that 100 follower benchmark on YouTube, we'll live stream on there and hopefully make it all easier and give you guys the best product that we can. So if anybody's watching right now, sorry, because it's kind of it's a little half in the bag.
Right. Yeah, everybody, thank you. Thank you for following us. Please follow us on YouTube. Like Phil said, if it's your first time, welcome. We're excited to have you. We've got a good guest here with quite an interesting career. We're looking forward to hearing his stories. And yes, enjoy our tangle of wires because we are not professionals. We just pretend to be.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, and always, you guys can follow us on every social media platform at They Had to Go Out. You guys can submit your own stuff using They Had to Go Out hashtag and direct messages, whatever. There's if you go to our website, theyhadtogoout.com, there's a new feature to do like voice messages. So we get to add you guys straight into the podcast if you record one for us. We haven't gotten one yet, so first guy to do it, we'll throw it up there as long as it's PG-13, maybe R.
Yeah, it depends.
Maybe R.
We're trying to diversify our audience, make sure the younger generation can listen too. They can learn stuff.
Very true. Hey, so we've got a treat for you guys today, because he was referred to as by one of my favorite guests so far, Mr. Mario Vitone. These two are friends, and you know a friend of Mario's is going to have a good story for sure.
Absolutely.
So who we've got on the line today? CWO4 retired Michael Carr, born in New York City, grew up in Washington, D.C. He is our first Coast Guard Academy graduate on the show, graduated with Class 77. Started out as an ensign on board the Coast Guard cutter Sweetbriar, it's a 180 buoy tender.
Yeah.
Went from there to Navy Dive School, certified as a diver, got assigned to the Atlantic Strike Team, and that was based out of East City at the time, Elizabeth City, North Carolina. I'm guessing that's where he and Mario probably met, somewhere around there.
Yes.
Yep. Then went to MSO Hampton Roads, and just the hate of Hampton Roads. No, I'm just kidding. Bill and I are familiar, very familiar with the Hampton Roads area. But after MSO Hampton Roads, he got out of the Coast Guard as a lieutenant, ended up joining the Army. That's where the CWO4 came in, and stayed with the Army until 2015 when he retired. He was in the watercraft operator MOS, or that specialty. Now he runs his own company, Hayes Gray Maritime, out of Florida. Florida.
Florida.
Perfect. Yep. And And with that, I'm going to let Bill ask Michael the question so we get him talking.
All right, Mr. Carr, welcome. And that's the question is, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or story, sir?
Well, I think I'd like to share with you my experiences when we did the salvage and recovery of the Blackthorn, the Coast Guard cutter Blackthorn, which sank in Tampa Bay in 1980. And it was, most people in the Coast Guard are very familiar with the Blackthorn. It brought about a lot of changes in how we train and how we operate. And it was one of the most stressful but rewarding experiences when I was on the strike team.
Yeah, and Michael, take us back to how it started. So I know you're, you said you dove on the wreck, right?
Yeah. So,
how did dive school go? How was the what was your duty at the strike team? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So at the time, the Coast Guard had three strike teams, Atlantic, Gulf, and Pacific, and they all had divers assigned to them. But the diving duties were mostly centered around environmental protection. And dive school, Navy dive school, was focused on salvage repairs and ship husbandry, basically doing work underwater. So most of the missions we had on the strike team were around pollution response, either helping to pump off, stranded barges and ships and preventing oil pollution. So when the Blackthorn occurred, it's not something we necessarily had trained for. In terms of the body recovery aspect or the unplanned event that the Blackthorn, collided with the Capricorn, an inbound commercial vessel, and sank very quickly and was in the bottom of Tampa Bay. And there were over 20 Coast Guard personnel that died, drowned in the incident. So
how did you guys get the call, Michael? Like, what you said, it was kind of a unique mission for you guys. So what was the call like, when the order came in that for you guys to deploy and go? How did that go?
Yeah, so if you can imagine back in the 1980s, before all the high tech comms and cell phones and everything. So
was it before 82?
Yeah, 1980.
I'm out. can't get back that far.
Yeah,
I remember the 80s, but I was pretty young.
Yeah. So rotary phones and telex machines, but we had a command center at the strike team, and I don't know precisely how the call came in, but it was most likely a phone call that came in that, said, hey, there's been a collision, you need to get your and most of the time what happened is before the full facts on any event was known, we would get a call that just said, get your guys to the air station. We're going to fly you someplace because there's a problem. And then en route, we would get more information. So if it was an oil spill or a ship grounding, they'd just say, get your guys to the air station with your gear and we'll figure it out when we get there. So
how often did that happen?
So it's like every other Coast Guard mission. We just kind of figure it out on the fly.
Yeah. And I think, a little digression, I think that's the power of the Coast Guard, is that SAR cases and almost everything the Coast Guard does, you figure it out in the midst of it, because there's a million different scenarios for search and rescue and everything that the Coast Guard does. So you just have to, you can't wait and do rehearsals and do brief backs and, what about this and what about that? You just got to fire up the helicopter and go out there and figure it out. I think that's what attracts people to the Coast Guard. Certain personality is people that love to solve problems and aren't stressed out by ambiguity. So
that's definitely what keeps the best.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it does. It's people that don't mind getting the call out of the blue that says, pack your stuff, we're going, and they don't need to have all the answers. And I have to tell you, they enlisted all the bosun mates and DCs and MKs that I worked with on the dive team. They were the most fantastic enlisted guys ever. They all were so talented and made my job so simple. But anyway, so we got called to Tampa, but because it's the Blackthorn had sank, the Coast Guard doesn't have the capability to salvage a vessel. So the Navy harbor at the time a harbor clearance unit. Now they're called mobile diving and salvage units. But at the time, harbor clearance unit out of Norfolk was sent down there, as well as Army, EOD, anyone in the military that had divers who could respond were sent down there. And we all rendezvoused in Tampa and then started figuring out what to do. Fortunately, the Navy has an office, the Navy Supervisor of Salvage, which has contracts throughout the world with commercial cranes and salvage capabilities. So the Supervisor of Salvage quickly organized everyone, and barges were brought in, and we started doing a salvage operation. But the most difficult part initially was recovering the bodies, because there were still a lot of missing coasties. And so we spent the first couple of days or the first week diving the vessel to try and find these missing coasties. And we didn't find...
What did you know, like, when you got the brief, Michael? What was the... I mean, was the gravity... I'm just curious. Like, you know, now, right, we talk about this whole event with, like, a whole lot of reverence. What was it like at the time? I mean, you know, I can only imagine you got a whole bunch of blue at the bottom of the ocean right now. How did that come across to you guys? What were the briefings like? The kind of orders? Who was leading the way, I guess?
Yes. So there was a commander in the Navy, Commander Delaplane, who was I think made for his role as the salvage diving officer in charge. And he was very focused and knew, could separate and prioritize and keep people going. And so I remember the first mission was, we need to recover the people that are not, and there was this feeling that there was people trapped inside that were obviously no longer alive. But he said, we need to search around the vessel and as much as we can into the vessel to try and recover bodies. And once we've recovered the bodies, we can then move into the salvage phase of this, but let's find the bodies. And because I had sailed on a 180 in Alaska, the Sweetbriar, the Blackthorn was the same class, and the Navy guys, who are wonderful divers, but this was not a Navy ship, and they weren't familiar with it. So I volunteered right up front. I said, listen, I know these vessels inside and out. I served on one for 2 years. Let me dive and let my guys dive initially to look for the bodies. One, because we know the vessel, and two, it's fellow coasties, and I think it would be best if we were to recover our own guys. And the Navy was very understanding. They go, oh, yeah, we get it. And so that's what they set up. We put a barge over top of where the wreck was located, and we just started diving.
How far down were they, Michael?
It wasn't that deep. It was just outside the channel, about 60 feet of water, 50 or 60 feet. Relatively clear, you know, depending on the tide. And in Tampa, on a flood tide, it's pretty good visibility. On an ebb tide, where all the sediment's flowing out, it can go down. But we were diving surface applied most of the time. And, you know, you didn't have to see very far. You'd get on the wreck, and all you had to really see was what was right in front of you. So we would, we'd dive, and we just started methodically going around the outside of the vessel and then trying to penetrate as best we could. The Blackthorn was lying on her port side. That's where the damage had all occurred, on her port side. So we swam along and looked in portholes and, you know, opened watertight doors and went into the bridge. And there were two bodies that I recovered. One was in the, if you're familiar with the 180, back on the stern, there's the ladder leading down to officer's country. And there was, usually it has a little like doghouse so the hatch can be kept open at times without spray coming in. So there was one officer trapped in the back on the ladder well leading to officer's country. And then there was and I recovered him. And then there was another crewman that was trapped in the chart room, which we weren't able to recover. And I've actually written about this for GCAP, and I wrote a story for them this past year. He was trapped in that chart room because when the Blackthorn went down, there was a filing cabinet in the chart room that wasn't bolted in place, and it fell against the door in the chart room, and the door's on the port side, and it opens inward, and that crewman was trapped in the chart room. And, you know, it was, I could see him in the through the porthole on the starboard side, but there was no way we could get him out of there till we raised the vessel. And, you know, a result of the whole Blackstone incident was this re-emphasis on securing gear, bolting things down. Deck plates in the engine room had, you know, weren't bolted down at the time, and there was a real problem when the crewman tried to egress out of the engine room when the ship was sinking because the deck plates all came loose. So anyway, I'm digressing, but there was, you know, we did that, and then we started the salvage operation after we did the best we could to find everyone.
You didn't digress at all.
No, I was
captivated by that whole description of it.
Actually, question for you: Coast Guard's a small service, was even smaller then, and I know like Officer Corps even a smaller part of that. Any of the guys diving on it? I mean, was anybody finding it? There's the distinct possibility, like you were dealing with people who you knew in that situation, who were on that vessel. Anything like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, at the time, having been in Alaska and then on the strike team, I hadn't been stationed in the 7th District, and I didn't know if I knew anyone on there or not. There were other divers, enlisted divers on the strike team that I think probably knew, had better association because of being bosun mates and MKs and DCs that had been on there. But I can tell you that, and even though it was a long time ago, our focus was, we just need to recover these guys, they're fellow coasties, and whether we know them or we don't know them, our job now is to recover them. And I remember we were all like laser focused on, nothing else matters, we just gotta find these guys and bring them back.
Right.
What was the media interest like when you guys were there?
Well, there was a lot of media around, but I think we were pretty oblivious to it. And it, once again, it's the 80s, so there's not all this YouTube and, you know, there are no drones flying overhead and whatnot. But the Coast Guard District was really good about having a public affairs officer and keeping them, or having the public affairs officer keep the press away from us. I don't remember ever interacting with the press at all. All I remember doing is focusing on the diving. And, you know, we would, at the end of a day, we might tell the press officer, this is what we did, or this is what went on. But Commander Delaplane, who was focused on the salvage, knew we got to keep this from turning into a circus. So we're going to insulate the job of salvaging from the publicity of, you know, the newspapers and radio that obviously would take up your whole day. So I don't remember that being a problem.
Well, and I guess more technical questions. Like as an amateur scuba diver, I've seen, you know, I've dove on just wrecks before, but never like really went inside and stuff. What's the process for searching, you know, a cutter like the Sweetbriar? How do you guys mark it? How do you divvy it up? I don't know. I'm just curious how that goes down.
Yes. So that in the military, you cannot go inside a wreck in scuba gear. You can only go inside an enclosed space if you're using surface supply, meaning a helmet rig where you have a umbilical to the surface and you've got communications. And if you get trapped or there's a problem, you can stay there forever because you've got unlimited air and you can talk to the surface. So initially, scuba was used to do an external survey of the vessel, get an idea of how she was lying and what the extent of damage was. But then everything after that was done with surface supplied. And so I actually penetrated the bridge and down the ladder well to the outside the chart room when we were trying to see if we could recover the coastie who was in the chart room. So you get on the wreck and you talk to the surface and you tell them every step of the way, you know, you'd say, I'm on the starboard side, I'm entering the pilot house now, I'm going down to the lower side, I'm heading down the ladder well, and it's sort of a running monologue of where you are and what's going on, and they keep track of you. And there's there's often a second diver who's an outside tender who will monitor your umbilical and make sure it doesn't get fouled, and when you're done, you come back out. The big aspect of Navy dive school is that, you know, they tell you from day one that diving is just a method of getting to your work site. That if in recreational field, diving is something unto itself. We go scuba diving because we want to look at the fish or the wrecks and dive. We don't need to accomplish anything necessarily other than blowing bubbles. But in the Navy, it's like you need to get your job done. So time is money, and you need to get there, get to work. And in dive school, you have multiple projects and tasks which are all timed. And to complete a task and graduate, you got to do the task properly and in the allotted time.
Was it like Men of Honor?
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, was it like Men of Honor, Michael? Did they throw the bag down on you and, like, you know, at the end?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You eventually just had to hold your breath because you ran out of air to try and get it all done?
Yeah. Cuba Gooding did a great job in Men of Honor, and so much of that, a lot of that is the diving part of it, of putting things together underwater and all, is exactly how it's done. There was some Hollywood there, obviously, but...
Oh, you should have just left it. You should have left it at Cuba Gooding. Did a great job, because I would have been like, yeah, Ashton Kutcher, man, solid. It was right on it. We still got you?
Yeah, all right. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. Yep, no worries. So how long did it take to do the dive operations? Like, when you got the call, I guess from the time the cutter was involved and sank, when were you guys on site, and then when were you finished?
Yes. So we got the call, you know, we loaded everything up on a C-130 at the air station in Elizabeth City, flew down there, got the stuff unloaded. You know, it's a blur of activity. You're just, you know, going. And then we spent a little less than a month diving on the wreck and recovering bodies. So the big task after the initial body recovery was to get the Blackthorn upright on her keel and raised to the surface. So in order to get her upright on her keel, we had to run metal or cables underneath her, and a big crane on the surface would then parbuckle her, turn her so she was upright on the bottom, and then slowly raise her to the surface. The extent of the damage on the port side was massive. There was a hole in the Blackthorn from the bow all the way back almost to the stern. And so you couldn't patch her and then, like, you know, try and pump her out and raise her. It was quickly determined that we're going to have to raise her when she was full of water and then pump her out when she was on the surface. So it was a huge crane, a lot of weight. And the other thing we discovered was that there was 20 plus crewmen that were never found either outside the vessel, you know, or on any of the spaces we could easily access. And the ones we didn't find were all or mostly engineers. And we determined after talking to the shipyard, the Blackthorn had been in the shipyard. That's why she was in Tampa, and she had been leaving the shipyard. And there was a lot of issues in the engine room, leaking valves and gaskets and stuff. And when they were departing, and when she sank, I had the collision with Senko's at night. When she departed that evening, most of the engineers were in the engine room, and so quickly determined that high probability that all of these missing crewmen were in the engine room. But we couldn't penetrate the engine room when the vessel was on the bottom because there was too much oil and debris, and it was determined to be too dangerous to try and pull them all out. So the decision was made, we'll raise her, we'll parbuckle her, get her upright on the bottom, raise her up. And as soon as we get her awash, we'll start pumping her out, and then we'll go into the engine room wearing SCBAs, and we'll see what's there and likely find the rest of the crew and pull them out. But so we did that, and myself and three other Coasties all volunteered to be the ones to go down in the engine room to look and do the recovery for the bodies. There were some... And this is interesting. There were some Commander Delaplane got everyone together and he said, listen, I need people to go into the engine room, but the boat's been submerged for almost a month. And if their body's down there, this is going to be kind of gruesome. And I don't want to tell anyone they have to do this. I just want volunteers and who's ever willing to do this. So, you know, I was a lieutenant at Dimer JG. And, you know, I was the officer in charge of the dive team. And, you know, I volunteered. And I'm not saying that because I want any kudos. But I just realized that as the officer in charge of the dive team, I had to do that. Or whoever was in my position had to do it. And, you know, that's just what we had to do. And so I got my team together, and there were more than, there was a bunch of other crews. And I said, who wants to go? And some didn't want to do it. Some said, no, I just can't do this. And so I got three other guys that were willing. And so we went down into the engine room, but it was really tedious and difficult because all the deck plates had come up and there was no way of getting down. So we had to rig a ladder to go down and find deck plates and put them back in place. If you've ever been in an engine room, you know you can't move around without having the deck plates. And we found a lot of bodies, all the missing bodies we found in the engine room. And since this is a true story, I just should probably mention this. There's only two ways of getting out of the engine room in a 180. There's an escape scuttle on the starboard side forward that leads up into the mess deck. It's a little 2 foot round escape scuttle. It comes up right on the aft end of the mess deck. And then there's the main ladder leading up that's amidships. Well, when the collision occurred, most of the crew could not get out because the deck plates all came on. You know, we weren't there, but this is what most likely occurred. The deck plates all came out, and because the ship went down on our port side, there's likely, and we sort of saw this afterwards, the coroner confirmed it, there was an air bubble that formed on the starboard side of the engine room, and all of the crew down there probably went up into this air bubble that was on the starboard side, but due to the engines and generators being hot and the mess that it must have been, they couldn't get through this escape scuttle. So we basically found all the crew members up there on the starboard side, clustered in the overhead.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
And it was a mess. You know, I look back on it now, and I just think that's what probably causes PTSD in people. But, you know, at the time, we just did it. We took Stokes litters and body bags and we SCBAs, and we just went down there, and we worked all day getting those bodies out of there. And, you know, it's just what we had to do.
Right. What kind of gear are you wearing besides the – and you said SCBAs, and this is 82?
Yeah, so I remember we had Survive Air, SCBAs. I don't know why I remember that, because anyway, we had Survive Air made by U.S. divers, because we had U.S. divers dive gear, so we had SCBAs, U.S. divers, and then we had Tyvek coveralls, you know, we had, and just normal rain gear that we duct tape, you know, very crude. You just put on PVC rain gear and duct tape gloves over it, and you just wore the SCBAs and it went in there. And, you know, this was before a lot of the protocols for responding to hazmat. And I'm sure now with bodies that have been in the water decomposing and the possibility of, you know, all the chemicals and oil, that you'd have a much stricter, but am I allowed to curse? Am I allowed to?
Oh yeah. PG-13.
Yeah. PG-13. No F-bombs.
So in my Army warn-up language, you know, we basically just said, fuck it. We got to do this. We can't be standing around going, oh, what about contamination? Oh, what about this? We said, there are coasties in there, and we got to get them out. And so who's going to do it? And, you know, we just did it.
Yeah, and I think, Michael, regardless of what the manual might say today, I have a strong feeling that you'd get the same response out of a group of coasties today. Like, we're going to get this job done, however we're going to get it done.
And I could add something. After I, you know, just fast forward, from that experience, after I went into the Army years later, the Army is like the other end of the spectrum from the Coast Guard in terms of culture and protocol. And the Army is very much about stay in your lane and follow doctrine, and there's a chain of command. And when I worked my way up to be the skipper of vessels, and many times you were given missions to do, and there were issues that would come up that in the Coast Guard, a vessel master, you know, the skipper of a Coast Guard cutter would say, oh, I get it. This isn't written down anywhere, but I know what to do, guys. This is what we're going to do. And then the Coast Guard, that's what we do. We just solve problems. And then the Army, many times, like, oh, chief, you can't do that doctrine or whatever. You know, no, you got to get permission from the colonel. And I would say, fuck the colonel. Not literally, obviously, but, you know, we got a job to do. We can't be calling back every 5 minutes to the base and say, hey, I don't know what to do. Tell me what. So, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I said to my Army crews, listen, I've seen some shit, and this is what, there are times when you just have to do, you're an officer or you're a senior NCO, you know right from wrong, and you know what needs to be done, and you got to man up and just do it. And if later on someone wants to hold you accountable, then fine, go face the skipper on the green carpet. But if you've done the right thing and you can justify what you've done in the context of it, you weren't being rash or irrational, or you weren't being, you know, necessarily taking risks, but you said, you know, the guy fell in the water, I had to go do it, this seemed like the appropriate. No one's going to fault you. You know, the worst thing to do is to stand on the dock and go, oh my God, I don't know what to do. There's no doctrine. There's no procedure. We'll watch this guy drown. And I think, in those days, and hopefully the Coast Guard's still like this, we succeed because we're willing to evaluate and take responsibility and get the job done. And, you know, I think you see that in Katrina response and other responses where the Coast Guard does such admirable things and everyone else is going, oh, my God, how'd you guys do that? It's like the magic sauce.
Yeah, and I'd say, I mean, it's still there. I think
we just figure it out.
Yeah, and you know what I've always noticed too is like the guys that are the guys that do call you out, you know, that try to call you on the carpet whenever something like that happens. One, no one respects them, and two, I'd rather have the guy to the left and right of me say, "Hey, that was solid," than really care what, you know, whoever else thought. That's what I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. And there were times in the Army where I got. More than once, when I got called on the carpet.
Surprise, surprise.
That's a good story.
And it's, you know, it's not a colonel or lieutenant colonel would say, chief, you know, what's the major malfunction here? What is your problem? And I go, sir, I take full responsibility, and I'd like a moment to explain to you why I did what I did. And usually, you know, once I explain to him, he'd go, oh, I get it. Okay, that makes sense. All right, well, don't do it again without letting me know. You know, get back to work.
You're a Coast Guard veteran. I get it.
Right.
You get it. You get a pass every now and then.
You're not wearing blue anymore.
So, yeah, it was. But I think there are times when you know what the right thing is, and you know in your heart what you have to do, and you just do it. So, you know, we recovered all the bodies from the Blackthorn, and they salvaged her, and then. You know, after that was done, that was sort of the end of the mission. We cleaned up all our gear, and we went back to Elizabeth City. And, you know, it was not strange, but we just all went back, and we cleaned up our gear, and we went back to work. And it was, you know, the Coast Guard went and back and made a lot of changes in how vessel crews are trained and how vessels are operated. But from our perspective, we felt successful, I guess. We felt like we had lived up to what we needed to do at the time.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you had a lot of, I'm sure you could feel the gravity of the whole situation too, right? I mean, just knowing that that's something that doesn't happen. Right. You know, we don't lose ships. We definitely don't lose people in mass like that.
Right.
Yeah, I could only imagine. Did you guys, what about the funeral services and stuff? Was there any follow-up for memorials or anything that you guys were involved in?
No, I didn't. I wasn't involved in anything after that. It went back to East City, and within the Coast Guard and the unit itself, there was memorials. But I never really got involved. In fact, it's kind of interesting. I had never gone to visit the Blackthorn Memorial that's down on right here at the entrance to Tampa Bay now. I had never visited it till this past week, and since you mentioned Mario, I was over in Tampa visiting Mario, and I had a couple of hours before I could meet up with him, and I drove down there to visit the Blackthorn Memorial, and I stood there looking at all those names and looking out at Tampa Bay, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, it just brought back lots of memories, and it brought back more than the Blackthorn, or brought back more memories than just that event, because while we were salvaging the Blackthorn, that's when another ship hit the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, and they had that disaster where all the cars fell into the bay, and we had to divert from the salvage of the Blackthorn to go recover bodies and debris from cars that had gone off the bridge. So
did you see it happen? Were you guys like, were yeah. you? Yeah, you were out there at the time. Wow.
I didn't realize those two were that close.
I didn't either. I had no idea. Yeah.
Yeah, we were standing. I was on the barge waiting for my turn to dive, and you could see the Sunshine Skyway Bridge because we were just a mile up, or less than a mile in up the harbor from it. And someone, you know, said, "Holy shit, look over there!" And we saw the ship hit the piling, and we could see stuff. We didn't know it was cars at the time, but we could see stuff falling into the river. And then the VHF, you know, within a couple of minutes, the VHF was going crazy with the pilot talking and the Coast Guard responding. And then quickly we got a call, send your small boats down to the bridge with blah, blah, I got cars in the water.
When the first thing you say is, holy shit, did you see that? You know it's going to be a busy day.
But, you know, I should add something, too. You know, when we first made our dives on the Blackthorn, and I myself and some other Coast Guard divers were the first ones. So here's this ship on the Coast Guard cutter in the bottom of the bay. No one knew what it looked like or what the configuration was or what we were going to find. So when we dove the first couple of dives, I can tell you, I was freaking breathing and hyperventilating, if you'd say, on, you know, what to expect. I had no idea. Are we going to dive down there and there's going to be dead bodies all over the place? Is the vessel going to be, you know, upright or on its side? Is it, what in the heck? So it's like this unknown. And I tell you, you really have to dig deep in those situations. And I remember saying to myself, you know, Michael, get your shit together. Just do your job. The Navy taught you how to dive. You're a Coast Guard officer. You've been trained to do this. Like, freaking get your head in the game and just do it. But you have to sort of say that to yourself. And I know from flying with Coast Guard pilots in some hairy rescues, it's, you know, I think the general public sometimes doesn't understand or appreciate how much inner, like, strength you have to develop sometimes when you really want to say, holy fuck, I want out of here, this is not good, and you go, no, we can do this, just stay calm, do what you've been taught, you know, and if you're surrounded by other good people, then you look around and you go, okay, we can do this.
No, absolutely, well said. The lesson for today is get your stuff together and do your job.
Do your job. And I think we all learned, you cannot train enough. You know, everything you do in training comes back to help or haunt you. And all you have to do is go through one bad SAR case or one bad maritime accident to realize, I can never overtrain. I can never get in too good a physical shape. I can never PM my gear too much. I can never think through problems too much. You might not use it today, but, you know, 5 years from now, that little skill you developed and refined will pay off. So.
Right. Might 100%. Save your life for another one someday.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the other lesson that was surround yourself with other guys who want to do the right thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we automatically do that. It's the Coast Guard.
We do. There are a few. Yeah, awesome story, Michael. What so I know when we talked on the phone, we had you also relayed, and I heard a little bit about this at one time, a plane crash on the Potomac during winter.
Oh yeah. So the Air Florida crash. Yep. At the same time, in 1981 it might have been, Air Florida, an airline that is no longer in service, but Air Florida jet took off from National Airport in January, heading to Florida, and it lost it. Its wings iced up. There's a lot of information on what caused the accident. But anyway, the wings iced up and it crashed in the Potomac River, and it was a very cold winter. There was 4 inches of ice or something on the Potomac River, and it clipped the 14th Street Bridge, and it crashed into the river and sank, and you know, only a couple of people survived, and there's a video of a bystander jumping in and rescuing one of the flight attendants, and we got called, so immediately we got called, and the Navy got called, and we all mustered up there and did the salvage operation on the Air Florida crash through the ice, and there was, you know, once there were big obstacles. One was it's freezing cold, so you had to use dry suits and hot water suits and deal with the cold. And because the plane crashed between two bridges that have very little clearance, you couldn't easily get any barges or vessels up over the crash site. So they had Army LCMs, landing craft, that had to take acetylene torches and cut the masts and some of the superstructure off to get them under the bridges. And but we ended up, once again, Commander Delaplane, the same commander from the Blackthorne incident, he took control, and the Army divers and Coast Guard divers and Navy divers, we all converged. But we had to develop this another scenario because the ice covered the river and it would freeze over every night. We tried to dive 24 hours a day, but we had to take breaks at times. The Army Corps of Engineers set up a gridding mechanism like a survey, and we divided up the river into little 1 meter grids, and then we could dive, and then using mapping where the bubbles were coming up, because there was very little current, map where the airplane was, and then we cover pieces of it. But the problem was that it was all this jagged aluminum, and the water is so cold that if you cut yourself on the aluminum, you would never feel it, and you could really slice yourself. And some of the divers did get some injuries, and you wouldn't know it till you came to the surface, and you could only see about a foot. So you'd get on the bottom, it wasn't very deep, 20 feet, and you'd move through this mud by feel, and you'd come across chairs or seats that had passengers still in them, and you'd say, I'm at a seat, and then mark where your bubbles were, and then we would recover. But we tried to do most of the recovery at night, because we didn't want news crews on the bridges taking photographs of these bodies coming up strapped into chairs and all of this. So there was a real, we found the remains and then we'd map it and then try and do body recovery at night. The only thing that was brought up.
Yeah, Michael, and you're talking about, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you said earlier, like, sometimes you got to man up and go do the mission, right?
Right.
You know, I feel the gravity of the Blackthorn, and then you just describing that, nighttime body recoveries in the ice.
Right.
Yeah, that's putting on your big boy pants, because that'd creep most people out no matter what. You know, not even thinking about the gravity of it, but just the sheer...
water that you can't see a foot in front of you in either.
Right, yeah. How were you feeling when you went down there? Was it like you take a couple deep breaths and then hit it? Or, you know, how did it go?
Yeah, so the first time I ever recovered a body, it was terrifying. And I was like, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I knew it was a fisherman that fell off a dock and we had to recover his body. And, you know, I dove down and I knew he was going to be next to one of these pilings. And I thought, you know, what am I going to come up? What part of him am I going to find first? His head all bashed in from hitting the dock or whatever. And fortunately, I came across his feet. So I was like, okay, I found him. But I don't know if it's terrifying is the right word, but it's very like, okay, stay calm. Just like do what you need to do. Tie a line around. You just have to focus on.
Unsettling.
Unsettling. Very unsettling. And you have to, I think, compartmentalize, at least I did, and say, okay, I found them. Check that box. Next box, tie a line on them that won't come undone. Tie that bowline that you learned to tie 1,000 times. Tie the bowline, cinch it up, follow the bowline to the surface. You know, indicate to the surface crew that the bowline's tied around his arms. Follow the line back down so you can guide him back up. Just do it. And then the Air Florida recovery, it was the same thing. It was like, it's not a body. Don't focus on whether it's male or female or it's a child. I found a seat. It's got a person in it. Talk to the surface. All right, I'm here. Yes, there's a adult male or adult female or adult in this. Mark the location. Roger that. Mark the location. You know, afterwards, you sort of deal with it. And I think back then, it's interesting. I know the Coast Guard probably doesn't do this anymore. But when we would come back from missions and we would go back to East City, we had a big warehouse there. The Atlantic Strike Team and the dive team had a big warehouse. And we would all sit in the warehouse on our gear and our generators, and we would go across the street to the PX and get a bunch of beer and put it in the cooler, and we would all sit in the warehouse and talk about stuff and drink beer together, and we would sort out, you know, how we did, what we didn't do, who could do better, how we were feeling. And I really valued that, because it wasn't officers talking to enlisted, it wasn't chiefs talking to third class, it was just all of us sitting down going, okay, what do you guys think? What's going on? And none of us ever got drunk or inebriated, but the fact that you had a cold beer in your hand and you could take a sip of beer and say, you know, I got to tell you guys, that really fucking freaked me out, and have someone else say, oh, me too, man. And it worked out a lot of the issues, so I never went home and had nightmares about it. It was like, okay, my buddies are having, you know, the chief bosun mate is like saying, I freaked out too, so we're all good, you know?
Yep.
And I think that's really valuable. I sort of miss the fact that sometimes we get too maybe there are things we used to do that have some value to them. But anyway, we worked through it all. I mean, we did it. We felt good about it, and we focused on it, and we were all dedicated to, like, we believed that the Coast Guard, you know, that saying that I love to use, that the Coast Guard's at heart is that hard nucleus about which the rest of the country forms in times of crisis. You know, we believe that.
I like that.
Still true.
Yep.
It's still true.
Yeah, that's good. Bill reminded me a second ago, you know, when you were talking about the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, about that, we kind of got off topic, you know, and I lost it. What, you know, when you saw it go down, did you guys just react right away? How did that one go?
Well, we realized really quickly that, oh my God, we're going to get involved in this. You know, I mean, it's like things are hitting the water and sinking. Oh, they're going to need divers. And it was like, I think we realized it, and we were starting to, like, mobilize our little boat. We had a lot of ribs and small Coast Guard utility boats and stuff. And we go, someone's going to call pretty soon and tell us to go down there. We might as well get going. And so, you know, by the time the MSO or the Coast Guard, Port Authority called us and said, we got a problem. We're like, yeah, we saw it. We're on our way. And then, you know, we had to continue with the Blackthorn salvage. So I, other than the first day, I didn't get involved much with the Sunshine Skyway Bridge because my assignment was, you know, the Blackthorn. So a lot of the Army divers got sent down to do the recovery for the bridge. And then,
how hectic was day number one, though? That would seem like, I mean, day number one's when you make a difference, right? Like, at least,
Yeah.
Did you make any recoveries off anybody coming down? Were you able to save anyone?
Yeah, with the people that lived through the Sunshine Skyway Bridge were people that either, they landed on the ship. There were some cars that landed on the ship and people survived. There were some people that hadn't gone off the bridge, that were just teetering on the edge, and they were able to be recovered. I'm having a hard time remembering if anyone that hit the water survived. I know there were people that died from either impacting the water or landing on the ship and dying there. But I'm not sure if I know we recovered people who did die, but I'm not sure if we recovered anyone that survived or not.
Right. And it's like, what, a 200 plus foot drop, I think, give or take?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a big drop. It was crazy. And, you know, the reason the ship hit the bridge is that when the Blackthorn sank, it was in the channel, and the Coast Guard had to change the channel coming into Tampa, and there was this weird little dog leg right under the bridge. So, you know, most times you go under a bridge, you know, you line up with the center span, you get 90 degree perpendicular to the bridge, you know, you use the light and you go under it. In this pretty straight shot, but because the channel had to be altered, you would go, ships coming in had to go under the bridge at an oblique angle. So it was a very tricky maneuver, and a rain shower had come through just before the ship coming in made the transit. And they had all this rain return on the radar. The pilot couldn't see the bridge in the rain, and they missed their turn, and that's when he hit the bridge. So it's like, first it was the Blackthorn, then it was the dogleg in the channel, then it's the Sunshine Skyway Bridge. It's like one disaster after another.
Right, all in like such a confined area.
It was a bad month for Tampa Bay.
Yeah. It's going into Tampa, a lot of harbors and ports, you look at the chart, and when you look at a chart looking down, and they go, well, this is pretty straightforward. You just go in here. But, you know, all of us have been to sea know that when you're on the water looking horizontally, it's a whole different ball game. And Tampa is a really tough harbor to come in and out of at night because there are very few prominent landmarks. There's a lot of day marks and a lot of lights. And it looks like a pinball machine coming in there. And if there's any rain or which there is in, you know, that part of Florida, a lot of rain showers and sometimes fog. It's a tricky place to come in and out of. You really have to have your plotting and your navigation down, and you can't get out of the channel. So it's challenging. It's a very challenging port.
Right, especially like, I mean, back, we're talking in the 80s with independent radar and, you know, baseline GPS, different time than now too.
Not playing a video
and it's
game
still kind of tough, especially at night. Yeah. Well, Michael, powerful stories.
Yeah, really.
For sure, and we so appreciate you sharing them with us today and with the audience and taking the time out to do that.
Yeah, thank you very much for your
time. Thank you for allowing me time to share it. I really valued my time in the Coast Guard, and it gave me all kinds of skills and relationships with other people that I value so much, so I was glad to be able to share.
What's the top lesson you took away?
I think the lesson I took away from not only the time as a diver, but my time in the Coast Guard, is the relationships, the people I worked with, regardless of where you go or who you work for. I think my best friends and my most valued professional and personal relationships are the people I worked with in the Coast Guard and the Army, who I went, you know, we accomplished some amazing things, and I think bettered our country and accomplished saving people's lives. And the skills that you learn, I think people sometimes don't value being a sailor or how important it is to know everything from knowing how to tie a knot, to plot a fix, to talk on the radio. All those mariner skills are so important. And being a professional mariner is something I take great pride in. And I think anyone that goes to sea should take immense pride in it. It's a real profession.
Should have been a bosun, mate.
Yeah, I know. I should have. If I had to do it over again, oh dear God, if I had to do it over again, I would become a bosun.
That's what they all say.
The good ones.
Yeah, I like it. Michael, awesome. Yeah, again, yeah. Thank you. And just to reiterate, everybody can find you now and more about your company at hazegraymaritime.com, right?
That is correct.
Awesome. So that's HazeGraymaritime.com. So make sure to get out there and visit Michael and find out more. Again, sir, we so appreciate it. Thank you again for your time.
Yep. Thanks for your time, Michael. Right. Take care.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Phil. I really appreciate it.
Have a great weekend. Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.